Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals. It's Wednesday, 9 February, and the High Court has today handed down two decisions concerning the nature of independent contractor and employment relationships. Those decisions are the CFMEU and personnel contracting, which dealt with a labourer engaged as an independent contractor by a labour hire provider, and ZG Operations Australia and JAMSEC and Whitby, a case involving two truck drivers who were contractors engaged by ZG Operations. I'm Krista Leonard, and I'm joined today by my fellow partner, Michael Mead, to discuss the facts and implications of these High Court decisions, which are likely to bring a level of comfort, I think, to businesses engaging contractors under contracts for service agreements. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Krista. Big day.
It is. Now, I think today we're going to focus on the decision in ZG Operations and JAMSEC, which I'll refer to as JAMSEC. There's much to consider in this decision, and there will be elements which touch on the personnel contracting decision, but stay tuned for a podcast in the coming days on that decision, where we'll also deep dive into what the High Court found. Now, Michael, before we get into detail concerning the potential impact of today's High Court decision, take us back to the beginning and tell us more about how the JAMSEC case made its way to the highest court in the land.
Yeah, thanks very much, Krista. So we have Mr. JAMSEC and Mr. Whitby, who were the drivers. They were owner drivers, and they operated trucks and the delivery of goods from about 1986 to 2017. They provided delivery services to the appellant ZG and the various corporate predecessors that had owned ZG's businesses over that 30-year period. Now, prior to commencing under the contracting arrangement in 1986, Mr. JAMSEC and Mr. Whitby had both been employed by one of the corporate predecessors as employed drivers. But in 1986, the company decided it wanted to change the structure of its driving operations, and it offered its drivers, including JAMSEC and Whitby, the opportunity to become contractors. It was also identified in the evidence that there were certain representations made to them at the time about insecurity and ongoing employment if they were to stay employees of the company. Now, from 1986 onwards, and for almost 30 years, each driver then operated a partnership business structure with their wives. Each partnership also owned a truck. Now, the partnerships were engaged to provide delivery services to the company using the partnership's truck under a series of written contracts that designated the partnerships as contractors. The partnerships conducted their affairs as one would expect from a business. This meant that they paid all the truck-related costs, they replaced the trucks from time to time without seeking company approval, they rendered tax invoices, claimed tax deductions and input credits, declared revenue earned from the delivery service as partnership income, and split, therefore, the income with their spouses, with their wives. But they worked exclusively for the company throughout that 30-year period. And in 2017, the company terminated the engagement of the partnerships in order to reduce costs. Now, that then gave rise to the partners, or rather the two contractors, seeking to commence proceedings, essentially asserting that they were employees and should be regarded as employees, and therefore receive benefits like annual leave, superannuation and the like. And it wound its way through the lower courts and to the full federal court, and then ultimately up to the High Court on appeal.
Now, at first instance, the primary judge dismissed the proceeding, finding that the drivers were not employees and did not fall within the extended meaning of employee under the superannuation guarantee legislation. And Mr. JAMSEC and the trustees then appealed that decision. And the full court of the Federal Court of Australia found that the drivers were in fact employees, and they made declarations to that effect and remitted the balance of the proceeding back to the primary judge. Now, the company, ZG, appealed that decision, as you say, to the High Court and argued that in circumstances where the full court had found that both JAMSEC and Whitby were conducting their own business, the court could not also find that they were therefore as well employees of the ZG operations. And they also argued that the way the full court had weighed the various considerations about how the parties had conducting themselves over the course of that 30-year relationship had been incorrectly done so. And this, I think, weighing is part of a well-established doctrine called the multifactorial test that has, I think, long been part of the methodology for assessing whether a person was a contractor or an employee. So tell me, Michael, why did the High Court decide differently to the federal court, and what did they say about the company's arguments?
Yeah, so Krista, I think as you said in the outset, the nature of the decision hopefully will provide greater clarity for businesses and operators that are using these independent contractor arrangements. And that's because the High Court really did focus its attention on the terms of the written contract between the drivers and the company. It said essentially that the written contracts that had been entered into were complete contracts, and they reflected a particular characterisation of the relationship. And that characterisation of the relationship was one of an independent contracting relationship. It hadn't been argued in any of the earlier stage proceedings, either before the High Court or indeed in the lower courts, that the contracts when they had formed were a sham, or indeed that they'd been invaried in any way as a result of the conduct of the parties, or some oral agreement. So, you know, what the High Court was left looking at and the focus of their attention was really as to the terms of these written contracts. Now, the view of the full court, or the federal court, was that, I guess, in addition to looking at the written document, there should be some consideration of the nature of the way in which that contract then played out over the life of that 30-year arrangement. And that there should be some broad inquiry into the nature of the way in which the parties had conducted themselves. And the High Court essentially said that that was not the correct approach. That where there was a comprehensive written contract, where there was no challenge in terms of how it was created, or whether in fact it had been varied, the court's task is to enforce the rights and obligations reflected in the contract and not to perform some multifactorial balancing exercise where the history of all the dealings between the parties is exhaustively reviewed.
This has shades of the High Court's decision in WorkPac and Rosato, which was handed down last year, doesn't it?
Oh, look, it absolutely does. And the High Court referenced their reasons in Rosato, which our listeners no doubt recall was handed down last year, as you said, focusing in on the attention of express terms of a complete written contract identifying Mr. Rosato as a casual employee and not that of a permanent employee, which was ultimately his claim, where he sought similarly entitlements like annual leave and other permanent employment entitlements. Now, in addition to this focus on the terms of the written contract, were there any other matters of principle that the High Court discussed, Krista? Can you take us through those?
Yeah, look, there were a few other matters which were of interest, I think, in the context of the court construing the contract that we can take note of. The first was the issue of the transition of the drivers from employees to contractors and what should be made of that. Now, the drivers had argued that they'd been pressured, that they'd had no option at the time but to agree to end their employment relationship and enter into this contractual relationship. And the High Court identified that the circumstances that gave rise to the making of the contract could be relevant in the interpreting of the terms. But in this case, they said that the lack of bargaining power that the two drivers had at the time they transitioned had no bearing on the meaning and the effect of the bargains that they then subsequently struck between the partnerships and the company. So I think that's what you were saying before about the construction of the multifactorial test comes into play at that early stage, at the time of the arrangements being entered into. And yes, while in this case, factually, the driver's evidence was accepted that they didn't have as much bargaining power, the court said, well, clearly the contract that you entered into was clear on its terms and you understood those terms and indeed you agreed to them. Now, as you say, there was no suggestion of there being a sham arrangement here. That's not what was argued. And the High Court acknowledged that that may be a factor in the case of a sham contracting claim, that you could look into and behind the terms of the contract in that case to see if there's an intention to shift the nature of the relationship. But ultimately, I think that, you know, factually, the shift from employee to contractor and indeed a business changing its business structure to ultimately, you know, change the way it characterises the workers is and does happen from time to time. We see that, and the court said no problem in this case with doing that. Another critical or distinguishing factor was the way in which the partnerships were structured as a business. And look, the High Court agreed that the partnership earned money from the company, that it incurred expenses associated with the ownerships of the trucks, that they took advantage of those tax benefits, and as you said before, they were also splitting the income with their partners to enjoy those tax benefits. It was not possible, when looking at those facts, to reconcile these matters with the contention that they were not, in fact, running their own business. And, you know, when we looked back and the federal court decision was handed down previously, I think we were all scratching our heads as to how that couldn't have been a key factor in the federal court's decision. And I think the High Court's done well and correctly, if I can say so, you know, really shifted the focus and got it right in that respect. And I think finally, Michael, the contractual arrangement was also not just for labour, but it was also for the provision of the trucks to deliver the goods. And you could not divorce that labour from the equipment, the ownership of the trucks and, you know, that was being provided. So there's some of the facts that were interesting in the context of this decision.
Yeah, and Chris, that point that you make about, I guess, the way in which you might characterise the nature of the operation, whether they're performing, I guess, their own business, that was an argument and a way in which the counsel for ZG really did frame up some of their submissions to the High Court. But it seems like, so what you're saying is that, you know, that question of whether they're performing work in their own business, it's kind of an equivalent way of asking whether, in fact, the work that the individual is performing is that of an independent contractor. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I guess expressed in another way, the question falls to be answered still, though, by applying the multifactorial test. The question is, when do you apply that multifactorial test?
Yeah, and look, the application of the multifactorial test will yield one of two conclusions. Either a person doesn't have their own business in performing work as an employee in the business of another, or the person has their own business and is performing the work as a contractor. But I guess it's those indicia as existing at the establishment of the party's contract that is really the critical proposition in terms of considering that multifactorial assessment. That it's not simply a question of considering that multifactorial indicia as a criteria or consideration as to how the relationship might have played out during its life. The court was really focused in on the question of the inception of the contract and the party's agreement at the formation of the contract in terms of weighing up some of those considerations that you spoke about.
And I think that's the big shift. That's the significant aspect or thing to take away from this case, and one that I think will be welcomed by businesses who have contracting relationships on foot. What are other key takeouts for business?
Yeah, so I think it'll be a welcome decision, but if you're using these kind of arrangements or have them in your operations, you've got to do some things now. So, and one of those things is to review contract agreements and make sure they're well drafted. You know, the silver bullet or the success for the company in this case was really driven off the back of having well drafted written contractual terms that the court held were complete contracts, and therefore they didn't need to look beyond them in order to interpret the nature of the relationship in any great degree. And look, I think the other thing also to identify is this decision doesn't deal with sham contracting arrangements. And obviously where there's an allegation of some sham arrangement, the court may look to terms beyond the written terms of the contract. But as we've discussed to this point in the podcast, that wasn't a case that was run in the lower courts or presented before the High Court. Rather, the contracts in their written form were identified as legitimate and correctly established instruments that regulated the arrangement between the parties. I think also there's a live issue about, you know, how to deal with contracts that are partly written, partly oral, partly established by conduct. You know, this decision once again doesn't deal with those because of the nature of the contractual arrangement that the court was considering. So there might still be some water to pass under the bridge or some issues at play in relation to those types of arrangements as well.
Yeah, and I think certainly that application of the multifactorial test would have a greater bearing in those situations. Well, that's it. Thank you for listening today. Remember, you can download Kingston Reid's A Word to the Wise from any podcast app and listen to our back catalogue of podcasts. If you would like us to discuss a particular employment, industrial or safety issue, feel free to get in touch. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Krista.